thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Just right for the beach, a long drive, or walk by yourself, there are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, in the middle of a summer full of flash, we'll talk about the non-flashy topic of movie ratings. PG-13 and PG movies rule at the box office, but what it takes to get an R sometimes leaves people stumped. We'll talk about what ratings are for and how they function, if they function at all. Then, inspired by our collective lack of interest in going to the latest tornado movie, we'll look back on films where the weather is the villain. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is Kat Chow. Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I do social media stuff, and I write for Code Switch.
Well, wonderful. We're always happy to have you here. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
We sort of got on the topic of ratings after Stephen and I had a conversation about Boyhood. Mm-hmm. Because Boyhood, the Richard Linklater movie that has great reviews, it's really good, got an R rating. And Stephen and I got sort of talking about the kind of baffling nature of that R rating. And even now, having seen the movie, I'm not sure what it would be for. I assume it's for a scene that involves a bunch of teenage boys sitting around talking the way teenage boys often do.
It's F-bombs employed as verbs to signify the act.
Yeah.
And I believe drug use gets you very quickly to R country.
Even thinking about it now, that just feels so strange to me.
Well, there are many moments in my own boyhood. There are a few moments of my boyhood that wouldn't get an R rating, I'm sure, at some point. I'm just talking about language. I actually didn't use any drugs as a child. But I mean, so much of childhood and so much of being a teenager is being in situations where there are bad words. And I would so much rather my kids see Boyhood than any number of movies in which there, you know, these cataclysmic events where you see thousands of people swept away by a tsunami,
right.
But because there's no blood, it's automatically a PG-13.
Right. Yeah.
Problem is that the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, this process, the criteria by which they assign these ratings is completely secret. There is no transparency at all, so there is this back and forth with every film where the filmmaker submits one cut that gets a rating, and it's just this back and forth, it's endless back and forth. They never say, here's what to do.
Yeah.
They say, here's what the rating is. There are certain rules that you can kind of glean, and I think filmmakers have been doing it a long time, kind of know. Everybody wants a PG-13 because that means...
Which is a big part of the problem.
Because R-rated films actually make millions of dollars less than a PG-13 just in terms of accessibility and the number of people who go to them. It can have sexual content, but no nudity. It can have nudity, but no boobs. It's this weird, completely obscure, and not immediately apprehensible set of criteria, and that's silly. So we should talk a little bit about the 2006 film by Kirby Dick called This Film Is Not Yet Rated.
Right.
A very good documentary, which attempts to expose this process. It got a lot of hype around the time it came out because he hired a private detective to go and find who's actually on this board because it's a secret. But really, what the film really does lay out, beyond that whole drama, which is actually pretty exciting, there's scenes where they're waiting in the car and sneaking into the parking garage, it really shows that this particular association, this board, will treat male nudity one way, female nudity another, will treat gay content one way, straight content another, will treat sex one way, violence another.
Right.
And that, arguably, most of all.
Right. Exactly.
I think there are a couple of well-established issues about ratings that people kind of come back to over and over again. They're much more sensitive to sex than they are to violence. Mm-hmm. They are, as you say, much more sensitive to gay content than straight content. And I think all those things are true. And I think they've sort of always been true. Kat, what is your impression from where you sit of kind of how this has played out as you've kind of
as the person in the room to whom ratings have most recently applied?
Okay, yeah, actually. True. So I was thinking about this, and I was telling Stephen before we got into this room, I just For me, ratings have never been that big of an issue with me. Besides just getting carded when I go to a movie theater and people are like, are you sure you're older than
17? Do they 17? Really card at movie theaters?
Or when they're like, can I see your ID? It happened in the past like 3 years to me in Seattle.
Wow. I didn't know they actually did that.
When Stephen was basically talking about how throughout your childhood, you just deal with things that are so much more real life. Like, I remember when I was probably elementary school, going to middle school, I would read really, really explicit novels.
Well, sure. Yeah.
Terry Goodkind's books, Wizards First Rules, had really graphic sex.
Yeah.
And I remember just reading them. And I guess movie ratings, because I had older sisters, just never applied to me in the sense of what I actually consumed.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I was reading, like, Jackie Collins by the time I was 14, probably 13 or 14.
I had certainly read Forever by Judy Greenblatt.
Right. I think what's interesting about this is not just this question of content, how content lines up with ratings, but the shrinking of the R-rated world and the expansion of the PG-13 world, even just since maybe 2000. Mm-hmm. I was going back today looking at kind of big earning R-rated movies, because this year, if you look at really big earning R-rated movies, it's only 22 Jump Street and Neighbors, which are both like dude comedies, right? You can do it in a dude comedy. There are, you know, one or two action movies, Lucy, but I think for the most part, from dramas, it has kind of gone away. And it used to be that your mainstream adult dramas often were rated R.
Right.
I was looking back today, Jerry Maguire was rated R. So was Rain Man. So was The Godfather, which is more blood and all that stuff. But there didn't used to be this idea that an R rating was somehow something to be harshly avoided. You know, you would change your film not to get the NC-17 or at that time the X. You would not change your movie in a sort of a panic about getting an R rating. And I think now, this is kind of my point about Jerry Maguire. The scene in Jerry Maguire that undoubtedly I'm guessing is responsible for the R rating is a sex scene between him and Kelly Preston at the beginning of the movie, which is mostly played for comedy, but is very explicit. And I don't think that movie, if it comes out today, I don't think they leave that in. I don't think they leave that in and let you get the R. I think there's a sense that everything has to be PG-13 except for kind of hard R comedies where it's like a badge of honor.
Right.
Right. If they had released 22 Jump Street and it was PG-13, it might actually be a negative. There's those. And then there's your, you know, hard violence, horror, action. But this whole middle part of sort of mainstream adult movies that could be rated R because they had adult content and that was okay has kind of gone away, partly because that kind of movie has largely gone away.
Well, yeah, you have fewer and fewer R-rated action movies. I mean, when you think about movies that would have been done completely differently today, one that came up when I was talking about this topic over the weekend is Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
And Starship Troopers would never have been directed by Paul Verhoeven today.
Right.
It wouldn't have had his sensibility because they would have tried that to make that movie as a PG-13, and it never would have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what bothers me most about it, besides the sex is scary and icky, but violence, go for it, is it's become the gaming of the system, which has been going on for decades and decades. The gaming of the system has led to so much, I think, self-censoring. For the most part, filmmakers know what is going to fall within the bounds of a PG-13, and they make their film to suit that.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a more distorting lens than it was when, say, they added a few minor swears to E.T. to keep it from getting a G, which has happened a lot. And that still happens all the time, too.
To me, the R-PG-13 thing is interesting largely as a reflection of the entire kind of world that we're looking at. And I had an exchange on Twitter today with a guy named Scott Mendelson who writes for Forbes, who was making the point that the effort kind of in the early 2000s to create global blockbusters, the idea that everything had to be a gigantic global blockbuster, had killed off both the purely for adults movie. Just, it was fine that it was rated R because it wasn't intended to be interesting necessarily to teenagers. It was for adults. And also the movie that is purely for kids. And everybody feels, again, like you want to make sure it doesn't get a G. You want to make sure, you know.
God forbid.
So it's kind of pushed everything into this middle, this PG and PG-13. Because even if you look at a movie like The Lego Movie, that's a PG movie.
But if the ratings board actually responded to the real world, because right now, just this month, two ex-members of the MPAA board have set up a little cottage industry where they say, you tell us what rating you want to get, and we are going to give you the feedback you need to get the rating you want, which argues that this board, it's not a bunch of different opinions where people come together for any kind of thing, because it pre-exists.
Right.
We know what it will be. It's like this hard and fast criteria that they never share with anybody. It seems like in the world now, where if we're so concerned about kids seeing sex, and we're in a world where there is the internet, it seems like there's porn and there's this more or less sanitized, romanticized sex that you would see in a PG-13 or even an R film. Mm-hmm. Why are we devoting so much energy to keep that away from kids when we have, they're sneaking around the back door,
as it were. In addition to everything we've said, is I think it's pushed a lot of R-rated content onto television, which is another medium in which kids have much readier access. And I think it's one of the causes of so much quality television. You're Breaking Bads and you're Walking Deads and all sorts of these TV shows that everybody loves that are incredibly violent.
Right.
The people who might be making R-rated movies are now just making violent TV shows.
Yeah. Or are intended for adults, at least.
Yeah.
And when I think about this, too, I mean, I think about how so many people I know who are my age watch things on YouTube. And how are those things policed, to use that word?
Right.
And also, what happens when you don't really pay attention to those ratings, to the MPAA ratings? I mean, that art house IFC Center just completely chose not to heed those warnings. Or
about Boyhood.
About Boyhood, right. Mm-hmm. And so they continued to let people in who they thought, you know, should be able to watch the movie.
That's the other thing about the rating system, is that it's all voluntary, right? You don't have to do anything. You can release your movie unrated. All of the pressures are economic and practical. It's not a government system that absolutely forbids you from making your movie. And the history of the ratings board is very much that all of the self-regulation in Hollywood was established to avoid a situation where you would have government-imposed censorship of films. But the thing that I find offensive about it, to be honest, is the sort of scam that it's not a judgment of, like, you're doing something wrong. Because the way they always describe it is like, oh, it's just information for parents, right? But it grows out of, I brought a clip of a very old video that I found in which Julie Andrews in 1966, and this was before they went to the original GGPRX that they originally had. This was before they did that, when all there was, and this had been true for decades, all there was you got the stamp or you didn't get the stamp, and you had to get the stamp.
It's like approved by the Comics Code.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there was no, it wasn't ratings. It was just the stamp, and you had to get it. And in fact, what was happening in the 60s was people were just starting to be willing to release movies without the stamp, which is part of how they went down this road. In this clip, Julie Andrews explains what the seal of the MPAA means to you.
This seal is part of the self-regulation of the Motion Picture Association. It means that the film displaying the seal is within the creative boundaries of reason and good judgment, and that the theater showing this film supports the code.
Boy.
Wow. Reason and good judgment.
Mary Poppins talking about
that. Boundaries.
It's very, very judgmental.
Yeah.
And the idea that somehow they pivoted cleanly from, we're telling you whether this is within the bounds of reason and good judgment, that they have turned on a dime to the point where all they're doing is informing parents, is ridiculous to me. You still are having people who are shaking their finger and saying, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't put this in your movie. And that's what gives the heft to these complaints about the way they handle sex, the way they handle female and male nudity, the way they treat straight action versus gay action. It absolutely has this heft of what is offensive and what is bad for kids. If it really were just a parental information system, you would still have a set of questions, particularly about the even-handedness of and all that stuff. But it would be a different set of questions. It absolutely comes loaded down with this idea about you have bad ideas and you have good ideas, as opposed to saying These are all ideas.
Jack Valenti, who was head of the MPAA for many, many years, would always invoke the parents of America. This is what the parents of America want. We follow standards, he would say. We don't create them, which is the most disingenuous way of expressing it as possible. So what do you guys think of the HBO ratings, like L for language?
Well, and this is just TV ratings in general.
TV
like
ratings
TVMA.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's at least informative at some level. And I realize that if you look up your movie, you can also see theoretically what it's rated that for.
Right.
But at the same time, it's also like, who really believes when people say, oh, how am I supposed to find out whether this movie is appropriate for my kids? Nobody needs a ratings board for that. You can look it up on the internet. You can know enough about things that your kids are interested in to decide for yourself. That stamp of like those people is a terrible proxy for what's good for kids. And I think that's the sad thing, is that the one thing that it might have ever been helpful for that isn't judgmental, it's terrible at. Mm-hmm. Who on earth would be like, I'd rather my kid went and saw some bloodless violence action movie than that my kid saw Boyhood? No one really thinks that.
Yeah.
It's about... It's just, I don't know. It makes me crazy.
Obviously, I completely agree with you. The TV system at least doesn't seem as much to dictate what exists.
Right.
And I think that is what drives me bananas, is that movies, which is, you know, this incredible versatile medium, this incredibly historically important medium, what movies get made are dictated by like what certain theaters are able to show and how theaters can make money. And there's so many layers of things that are archaic about it in terms of how people consume entertainment.
When you bring that up about television, it makes me think of the fact that I cannot ever remember a creator of a television show saying that they had any awareness of or any interest in or any dictate to fudge the content of the show over the rating that got slapped on it. It may be that it happens,
but you know,
but I've never heard about it, whereas you hear about it with filmmakers all the time.
You hear about it with network censors. You hear complaints about network TV censors.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But generally, you know, if you are on a network, that you're going to have certain strictures, and those strictures get more broad if you are on, say, FX, and then they get broader still if you are on HBO or Showtime.
There are certainly content limitations. I'm talking about the rating. I'm talking about that rating box.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. We got a TVMA. We're
dead. Never even heard of a creator knowing what their thing was going to be. But anyway, I'm curious to hear what folks think about this. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. The other thing we were going to talk about today, this partly comes from something that we just could not kind of raise ourselves to do. When we were talking about the movies that were going to be out this week, it was like, well, there's this movie, Into the Storm, which is a tornado movie. But we all just kind of looked at each other and said, I don't want to go to the tornado.
Basically, the discussion was, can we talk about it without seeing it?
Well, and we're not talking about it. Right. I would never claim that we would ever do that. But it did get us thinking about the idea of movies where the weather is the bad guy.
Yep.
I kick it over to Kat Chow. Do you have a weather villain movie?
Oh, man. Yes, I do. So do you remember back in 2011 when...
Back in 2000.
Back in...
Let's just going to take you in the way back machine.
way long ago, back in 2011, that volcano in Iceland, I won't even try and pronounce it. I actually watched a YouTube video for 5 minutes trying to learn how to pronounce it. I think it's Eyjafjallajökull. I don't know. There's like a weird G sound.
No,
anyway,
of course.
Anyway. So when that volcano erupted, it stopped a bunch of flights. People were worried that a glacier would melt.
More.
That one glacier in the world. And I swear, that spawned a bunch of volcano disaster movies. I'm not sure if this one called 2012:Ice Age came from that eruption or was inspired by that, but I swear it's so similar. So the description basically reads, a volcanic eruption in Iceland sends a glacier toward North America, causing everything in its path to freeze. A family man struggles to escape the onslaught of the coming ice age.
That sounds rad. And let's go see it right now.
Yeah. I watched it yesterday.
Oh, you watched it?
Okay. So wait, is there any point at which thousands of people are killed, but a Muppet is saved? So we're all good?
Yeah. Basically. I think my favorite thing, though, about this movie, the premise is a 200-mile-long glacier is quickly moving and destroying cities, entire cities, and it's like
it's
one,
just hurtling.
Yeah, one hurdle.
Yeah,
it takes out Boston. It's probably going to go for New York. Yep. Who knows? Rhode Island is just gone.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I noticed as I was looking at various lists of weather movies, as I do. It seems like there are two kinds of weather movies, right? There's the twister kind of weather movie where it's a localized thing. But now we are moving into this climate movie phase. The Day After Tomorrow in, what, 2004, I want to say, which involves it opens with the ice shelf breaking off. And then, you know, panic ensues. And it's one of those things where, yes, it's about climate change. And yes, theoretically, it's about bizarre things happening with weather. But it happens just like Kat said about the 200-mile glacier coming at you. It's like all of a sudden the weather changes.
Sure, I know, yeah.
In The Day After Tomorrow, it's like yesterday it was fine. Today we're covered with ice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, of course, not the way people see it happening.
One of the challenges, I would assume, with making a weather-related disaster movie is you kind of have to pick a weather event that is sustained over enough time to support a movie. Otherwise, you are dealing with the aftermath of a storm, which is a different thing.
Yeah.
And so your tornadoes are much more useful than your earthquakes.
Yeah, given. Aftershocks, though. I think the film Earthquake had plenty of aftershocks.
Just constant elevating in intensity, I'm sure. Because you don't have a bad guy, you know, you don't have, like, the guy who sells out to the tornado.
Right.
who is, of course, dramatically killed in reparation. You have to have something that builds and escalates, but you don't ever really solve the problem.
You're discussing, Stephen, is the pathetic fallacy where we impute onto natural events these human emotions and human motivations. And that's why this whole genre, everybody has a genre they don't get, and this is the one I don't get, because it's the difference between spectacle and action. Action is about, for me, it's about the human body. It's about, like, actually being able to recognize, having a visceral reaction to things going on screen. Spectacle, you have an emotional reaction. It's very impressive. Your reaction is intellectual, like, they spent a lot of money. Let's look at that CGI. It doesn't resonate with me. Similarly, like you were saying, Stephen, I mean, all fiction is moral in one sense or another. So, like, we like to see the bad guys get punished, the good guys win. And when the villain is weather, then we have to kind of have the guy who's filled with hubris get it first.
Or the greedy guy. That's what happens in Twister, right?
That's exactly.
Isn't there, like, kind of like a rival gang of weather chasers?
There is. Here's the thing. I think Glenn is right that weather on its own does not set up a very satisfying set of conflicts. So when you see a weather movie, it is typically structured as some other kind of movie. Mm-hmm. Twister is a monster movie.
Yeah.
Twister is a monster movie that starts off with a small child who has a terrifying encounter with a monster. And many, many years later, she is still, you know, waiting to fight that monster and trying to kill it. Mm-hmm. There are a million monster stories that are the same way. In fact, the first Sharknado is like that. Where you find out that the girl who is determined to go fight sharks, it's because many years ago, something, you know, a shark killed my uncle or whatever. So Twister is a monster movie. The other thing you sometimes see with weather movies is that they are these movies about arrogance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very often when you make a movie about the weather, it is a thinly disguised man versus nature story about trying to fly too close to the sun.
Yeah.
And you see these movies where somebody will try to harness the weather in some way.
The things man was not meant to do.
Exactly. And so I think a weather movie can be like that, the same way that any natural phenomenon movie can be like that. I was trying to get a handle on kind of the idea of where these movies fit into other disaster movies, which is why over the weekend I watched The Towering Inferno, so excited about, which I've been telling everyone about because it's so bizarre and completely bonkers. But The Towering Inferno is about a fire. It's about a huge fire. And the entire way that that movie is structured is that that is about arrogant, rich people not just cutting corners and not following the fire code, although that's in there. But also just it's the idea that, like, they tried too hard to build too spectacular of a thing. Mm-hmm. They were arrogant. It was hubris.
So it's Titanic.
Yeah.
And Titanic is basically the same movie as Towering Inferno. I mean, it's about people getting trapped and being in danger because somebody has overextended themselves in terms of trying to be godlike.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think sometimes when you see weather movies, the ones that I find the most satisfying with any natural thing, whether it's fire or weather or climate or whatever, the ones that I find satisfying are the ones where there is under it some story idea about people, some story about arrogance.
But it never works for me because it's wind. The thing that you're fighting is really bad wind. Now, I do have a soft spot for Twister, and I'll tell you why. A, the cow. Now,
yes.
The cow,
but that's in the trailer.
Was in the trailer, right?
Oh, wait.
Not in the actual film.
But wait, no, it is in the film.
It
is? It's okay. In the film. Hang on. The cows are in the film.
Okay, good.
Another cow.
Good to know.
That poor cow. I mean, I just feel all the empathy for it, you know?
You're supposed to.
Cat's like, Twister is the story of a sympathetic cow.
Yeah. Also, Philip Seymour Hoffman, minor role, but really makes the most of it. The first time I actually noticed him, mm-hmm. just taking a very stock character and really making the most of it. But mostly, it's because the triumphant moment of the film, 20-year-old spoiler alert, is when these little meteorological sensor globes get taken up by the F5. And this is when the music swells. It's like, yes, thousands have died, but science! Science wins!
Well, and the really great, the exciting moment, the climactic triumph, is when you see all the data feeding out
of
computers.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. And that's like, and that's, I mean, ridiculous, but kind of
it's
great.
Also
it's
also awesome.
Kind of great.
Wow, you guys are just pausing to talk about how much you love Twister.
Well,
I don't love it, but it is its own brilliant thing. And as I was talking to somebody over the weekend about this, you can't beat the moment where, like, Bill Paxton picks up a handful of dirt to essentially read the Twister's
read
mind
the wind. Yep.
By handling this.
Let me read this natural disaster's mind that I'm personifying.
By sort of, he drops some of the dirt and he watches what it's doing, and he is like reading the mind of nature, and it is the corniest, dirtiest.
These films, I just don't think, have immediacy anymore, because we can now see on YouTube, you've seen those security cam shots of an actual convenience store get run through by a tornado, and those people hide in the coolers and they walk out. Or, you know, that one where there's, thank God, an empty school playground, which just gets obliterated in seconds. Once we have that seems to me like, okay, that I get. This whole stuff where we have the crooked person who didn't invest in the sheetrock well enough. It's like boring.
Well, and you know what's by far to me the worst example? And I'm going to, by talking about this movie, reclaim the 2 hours I spent watching it like 20 years ago. Have any of you ever seen The Perfect Storm?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That whole movie is what Glenn was talking about with the CGI spectacle, and then at the end you're basically like, oh.
I will say
that's the entire effect of that movie.
That movie, I found some of the stuff that happens toward the end of that movie so upsetting that it haunts me still.
Really?
This particular way of meeting your end is one that I do not like thinking about.
I don't remember this ending now. I'm going to have to go.
Well, I'm pretty sure they drown.
The perfect storm.
Everyone
the perfect storm does not go well for the guys trapped on the boat.
No, and this was, and it's weird. Like, we all complain about, like, oh, these Hollywood endings. Oh, everything has to turn
so
out a certain way. But when it doesn't happen, you're like, what? Why was I just watching that?
Yeah.
So I will say the thing that irks me the most about these disaster movies, which is totally weird because I'm not a science person at all, but it's the science and just how unbelievable it is to my non-science knowing brain, where I'm like, that can't happen. That, like, that 200 mile. Yeah, I'm offended by the 200 mile glacier, or I'm offended by these giant icicles coming to impale like entire houses and neighborhoods. I'm like, no, that would never happen. If I wrote this movie, that would not happen. It would be like freeze.
It would be like a 500 year long movie about global.
Yeah, my disaster movie would just be everyone would watch it.
Yeah. That's right.
When the movie is about science and it gets the science wrong,
that's
kind of especially irksome, I would imagine.
I'm pretty sure all the science in Twister is perfectly on.
You see it happening right before you in that last climactic scene.
Perfectly. All the data is coming up. The other great thing about Twister, not to go back to like the other great thing about Twister, but the other great thing about Twister is like this Cary Elwes character who...
He's the cocky meteorologist. He drives like the black van. That's how you know they're the bad guys.
And he has corporate sponsors. He's not doing it for the science. He's doing it for the money.
He sold out to the tornado.
So you know that the tornado is going to eat him. You know it is because he's the bad guy. And he never listens to Bill Paxton when Bill Paxton tries to give him advice. Bill Paxton is like, the tornado is going this way. And he's like, but I have fancy sponsored science equipment that says, no, I'm not listening to you. You know, he's like getting ready to meet his doom.
He's Wayne Knight in Jurassic Park.
Yes.
To bring it back to the monster.
He really is. He really is. Well, once again, if you have more weather movies to suggest to us, or if you just want to talk about Twister, come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and talk to us about that. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Spent a little chunk of the weekend in Baltimore, a city surprisingly near to me that I never go to, and took the opportunity to visit the American Visionary Art Museum.
That's awesome.
It is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It includes, among other things, a 10-foot-tall statue of Divine that rotates because Baltimore. And if you're going to have a museum of oddities in Baltimore, you had better have some sort of John Waters connection. But the overall message of the American Visionary Art Museum is it's art made by obsessive people. And it's kind of by obsessive people for obsessive people. And it's a mixture of kind of beautiful minds. And this guy built this incredibly elaborate sculpture out of matchsticks. And this guy makes beautiful art out of bits of broken glass. And here we turned a car into this thing of beauty by gluing thousands of little blue bottles to it. And it's just this wonderful just window into the minds of obsessive artists. Some really ugly things, but a lot of incredibly beautiful things. And I think my favorite thing about it, my favorite little detail of it, is way up on like the third floor, there's a big old cabinet, and inside it are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Pez dispensers.
Right.
The decision that they clearly made with the cabinet of hundreds of Pez dispensers, which is kind of just sitting in the hallway, they understand that collectors are obsessives the way a lot of artists are obsessives. And they make the point at various points around this museum that there are obsessives all throughout, you know, athletes are obsessives, that people who achieve greatness in all sorts of capacities are obsessive people. And it's kind of this tribute to single-mindedness and kind of just finding the beauty in unexpected places. It's a wonderful museum. It's not a particularly expensive museum. I highly recommend it. It's really, really beautiful. The American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore.
Seconded.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The PS3 downloadable game, Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. I think it's now on PS4 as well. Linda Holmes, you should get this. It's a very short game. You're going to polish it off in an afternoon. Basically, it's two brothers must work together, and they must traverse mountain, hill, and plain to get the Franzipans to save their dad from...
I've played this.
You have?
Yes.
Okay. You solve some puzzles as you go along. Your older brother, you move with the left thumbstick, the younger brother you move with the right thumbstick, and over the course of the brief time you spend playing this game, you get muscle memory and you really learn how to make them work together.
It was so lucky for me when I played this game that it was impossible to fall off mountains.
Yeah.
Like you just keep running but you stop moving. I would never have stopped falling off the mountain because I can't do the two thumbs at the same time.
Now to me, toward the end of the game, and I'm not going to spoil this because I went into this not spoiled, but the means by which you interact with the game goes through a pretty big change. And that change and the reason behind it is legitimately moving. This moment, moreover, could only happen in a game. It's a moment that is kind of you are invested in an ergonomic way in how you play this game. And it just reinforced to me that we are only beginning to scratch the surface of this huge art form that is video games, and that anybody who says that video games can't be art, the ghost of Roger Ebert, is just flat wrong. So that is Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
What is making me very, very happy this week is I started season 2 of the PBS series called Mind of a Chef, which is really, really wonderful. And I recommend that everyone at least watch the first season. The first season features this chef, David Chang, who is the owner-restauranter behind Momofuku Milk Bar in New York and a couple other restaurants. And it's like this deep dive into cooking in a specific area. So in season one, it's about all sorts of Asian cooking and the roots of it and how David Chang really does fusion. He goes into katsuobushi, which is essentially dried fermented fish. He talks about its history. He tries to make his own katsuobushi, but in pork form. And so you have this really awesome, intricate look of how food works in different cultures. And it's just a really beautifully shot series in general. And so I think that they're about to roll out with the third season, which is going to feature two different chefs, a Swedish chef, and then also Ed Lee, who is a Korean chef, and he kind of merges Korean and Southern cooking. And so for anyone who is...
I think he was on Top Chef.
I was just going to say, I think Ed Lee was on Top Chef.
Oh,
maybe.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. But it's a fantastic series that, not in just that like foodie way, like, oh, I want to know where my food came from. It makes you think about how like the history of food came about, what happened hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So I really recommend it.
And where did you watch it?
I watched it on Netflix, actually. Okay. So it's streaming there. It's also streaming on PBS's website, too.
Thank you very much. So let me ask you guys a question.
Yes.
Have you ever had one of those weeks where you suddenly realize that you haven't done anything in the last week except your job and things for your job and things that will eventually be about your job? I've had that kind of week. Mm-hmm. So as I looked at what is making me happy this week, I had a terrible time finding something that I had taken the time to do that I have not either already talked about on this show mm-hmm. or watched or did because I was going to talk about it on this show, like mm-hmm. Twister and The Towering Inferno, or something that I have already talked about on some other thing that I have taped or done. So I have nothing to offer this week except that, except I'll say two things that are job related because everything is. One is that I've been spending a lot of time, to be a complete homer about it, I have been spending a lot of time with NPR One, which is our new mm-hmm. app, plays radio stories and podcasts and lots of NPR content, and in some places is already well integrated with local stations. In other places, I think will be more integrated as time goes on. It has increased the amount of NPR that I listen to. I've always listened to the shows some of the time when I'm in the car, especially, but I listen to it more now and I've been enjoying it a lot. And that's, I would not have said that I was, you know, that I knew for sure whether this was going to be up my alley or not, but I've really enjoyed it. And if you haven't tried it, again, it's called NPR One and it's available from the iTunes store or as an Android app. And it's really cool and I've been enjoying it. So that's A. B is that if you listen to this show and if you download it regularly, you may have gotten to hear that last week Stephen and I did what we called a small batch edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour, which was just the two of us chatting about Boyhood, about Linklater's Boyhood. And it's part of something that we're doing for a whole variety of reasons. It's one of those ideas that you have and then you think about a whole bunch of reasons why it might help you. We've been working on a couple of those, and we've gotten some lovely feedback on them. So if you have not tried those, we hope that we will have more soon. And it's always really nice to have a new project.
It'll also swallow up more of our available what's making us happy this week. Yeah.
It's true. And, you know, there are people in the world, as much as I like to think we make a fun show, there are people in the world who don't have 45 minutes every week to listen to a show like this, but might have seven or eight. So, you know, we encourage you to try it, and we thank you if you have tried it. That's all I have is my job. All I have is job stuff this week, you guys. I don't know. It's really sad. It's really sad.
You're acting as if this is the first time that this has happened to you or any of us.
No, I know. But I just have job things. So that's what's making me happy.
Nothing wrong with that. It's good job things. It's job things to be proud of.
It is. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And as always, you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Just right for the beach, a long drive, or walk by yourself, there are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington.
Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.